Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and go to Cairo, Egypt for an update on the aftermath of the revolution as exuberant and exhausted young Egyptians return to classes with the military firmly in control of a country they have ruled since independence. Sheila Carapico, the chair of the Political Science Department at the American University in Cairo, joins us. Then we'll talk about Yemen, a country that many analysts feel could be the next to go the way of Tunisia and Egypt. Charles Schmitz, the president of the American Institute of Yemeni Studies, joins us. Then finally, we'll talk with NPR's Deborah Amos, who is in Saudi Arabia. She covers the Middle East for National Public Radio and did a very prescient broadcast back in November featuring Egyptian youth using social media to push for political change. Let's now go to Cairo, Egypt. I'm speaking with Sheila Carapico, who's the chair of the Political Science Department at the American University in Cairo, where she researches the political economy of development with special emphasis on Arab countries. She's the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia, and her forthcoming book is titled Political Aid, Democracy's Promotion, and the Paradoxes of Empowerment. She's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. And I imagine you, Sheila, in Cairo there, along with all of the Egyptians in that city and throughout that country, are, elated and exhausted at the same time?
Yeah, I would say that summarizes it pretty well. There's still a lot of jubilation. The word on everyone's mouth is Mabruk, which means congratulations. And but at the same time, yeah, we're tired and, you know, also facing, not me personally, but, people around me facing huge challenges in the days and weeks and months to come.
Well, we spoke on the first day, and this has been about, 20 days, the 20 days that shook the world?
Yep.
And just towards the end there, it was almost unbelievable, the non-resignation. So I imagine people's emotions were whipsawed. Where's the sort of feeling now of both accomplishment and wariness? I would think that now the military are in charge, and let's face it, the military have always been in charge since the colonial British.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, you know, as I'm sure you've watched and talked about already, you know, there was great kind of despondency and disappointment on Friday morning, and then Friday evening, it was, you know, about 6 in the evening or something like that, around sundown, when, you know, the announcement that the president was leaving came out, and, I mean, the outpouring into the streets was just, I mean, I'm sure, you know, world historic, just unbelievable. And I myself was just moved to tears repeatedly. And a lot of people are still retaining that sense of euphoria. I mean, I went to, you know, we had started classes today at the American University, and, you know, most people from the janitors to the president are just and the students, of course, remain quite elated. But yeah, it is, and I almost hesitate, you know, to then turn to the negative side of it, because I think that regardless of what does happen in the future, I mean, a point has been made, and something has been proven that can never ever be taken back, which is that, you know, if enough people take to the streets with enough tenacity, they can bring down a very, very entrenched regime. And yet, as you say, I mean, what we have now is even more direct rule by the military than it has been, at least since the mid-50s, and in fact, you know, for most of the 100 years before that and before that. So the tasks, I think, are quite difficult, particularly as right now, although the Supreme Military Council has said, well, we're implementing the demands of the public by, you know, suspending Parliament and the Constitution. You know, one of the key demands, I think, and what would be, to my mind and many people's mind, the first demand, which would be to suspend the state of emergency that's been in effect since the Sadat assassination in 1982. I mean, that has not been done. People are being cleared out of the square. There's not a menacing military presence in the street, but there are, you know, tanks at pretty much every strategic intersection and in front of, you know, important buildings and so forth. So it does take, I think, a combination of trust in the military, again, not so much the army itself, which I think most people do trust because it's so much a citizen army, but in the high command, there needs to be trust in them to work with and ultimately cede power to civilian leaders, among whom I must say that I look in particular to probably more than two groups, but the first two groups I'd name would be the judiciary, which is a very strong judiciary in Egypt. There are very committed and highly professionalized judges and also attorneys and human rights lawyers. And so the judicial community, I think, has a phenomenal role to play. And it is also my personal view, although this, I think, maybe is my personal view, that there's also a huge role for diplomats and anyone who is skilled in negotiating. And then, of course, finally, you know, probably the biggest wild card is how civil society, the social groups who have been demonstrating, can kind of constitute themselves in a much more organized way than was required to demonstrate in Tahrir, to put together probably political parties and slates of candidates and to run a successful election. And that's just, those are just the things at the top of the list.
Again, I'm speaking with Sheila Karapiko, who is the chair of the Political Science Department at the American University in Cairo, where she is. And we're talking about the sort of day after, if you will, or as the dust settles. Now, your students, you mentioned your students are back in class. I think, well, first of all, I think it's somewhat, in retrospect, embarrassing to think of how the average American thought that Egypt was a kind of a democracy. I think that's fairly fair to say. And how these last 2 to 3 weeks have caught everybody by surprise and shown us in no uncertain manner how autocratic and dictatorial the regime was and how brutal the police and secret police apparatus is and how ubiquitous and how much it controlled their lives. Knowing these students now and then when they were chafing under this regime, does any of this catch you by surprise? Because, frankly, I think the world has been caught by surprise.
Well, I wouldn't probably have thought to put it exactly as you did. I mean, if Americans thought that Egypt was a democracy, then I think that was just something they were deducing from the fact that it's such a good ally of the United States. But no one familiar with the Egyptian political system would have thought of it as anything close to a democracy. And, you know, clearly Mubarak, I mean, did, I think, win a fairly legitimate election about 25 years ago, but you know, since then, the electoral system has become increasingly, I mean, bogus. What was surprising, though, I think, and what makes the youth significant, although it is not correct to say that it was a bunch of kids in Tahrir, but what makes the youth significant is that I think the older generation of Egyptians had come to think that this is the way it is and it's the only way it can be. And something sparked the imagination of people, I'd say particularly between, say, ages 20 and 30, you know, who are not children, but who somehow managed to imagine, to envision, to dream of something else, and then just to start to all congregate in the largest, you know, public space in the country and just sit there insisting that this was going to happen. And that, I think, is what took everybody by surprise, and that we are all still kind of just reeling from, you know, the unprecedented nature of such a thing.
Again, I'm speaking with Sheila Carapico, who's the chair of the Political Science Department at the American University in Cairo, where she is late in the evening, Cairo time. Now, Sheila, the real not only is democracy yet to be born in the sense of multi-party elections. The parties have been eviscerated over the years by Mubarak. And what I was meaning to say, I think, was that the average person, I think, thought of Egypt as an okay place, you know, and that nobody thought that this guy was particularly bad. Only people who knew what was going on, and that, frankly, we have a fairly, I think, a small political class in this country. But the long and the short of it is, we have most of the money and the power and the wealth in that country in the hands of a few of these crony oligarchs of the Mubarak regime, and you've got this situation with the military where they've been getting $60 billion from the United States over since Camp David. And have essentially created a kind of their own little military-industrial complex where they all, basically have benefited from the regime. So how are you going to pry that kind of control loose, the economic monopoly and the military monopoly?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think that's really a key question, and it's difficult to imagine. I mean, some people will be brought to justice, and again, I think the judiciary has an incredible role to play, and already at least a few people, are under investigation for corruption and also for human rights abuses, torture, and so forth. Although, parenthetically, I mean, I suppose could have been worse. I mean, it wasn't sort of Saddam Hussein, level. But in any case, it is very difficult to see how, as you call it, and many people call it, the military-industrial complex, which is a huge sector in the economy. I mean, they manufacture all kinds of things, you know, cooking gas cylinders and so many things. And it is difficult to imagine that will be dismantled. And so, you know, the question, I think, to my mind, I mean, it's very unlikely that that's just going to go away. The question is whether that can coexist with an actual civilian government, not merely, you know, it's possible, I think, under such circumstances to envision a scenario in which, you know, there are rather free and open elections, but that the parliament that they elect is fairly impotent. And so the key question, which cannot happen, I don't think, you know, immediately, is whether, there will gradually be the transfer of real authority away from, you know, the generals, the Supreme Military Council, to a civilian government, to the point that, you know, the military comes under civilian command and civilian control. And, you know, the model for that is probably Turkey, where the military was certainly in complete control for much longer than will happen in Egypt, but where, you know, gradually over, you know, a period of a couple of decades, really, it did become basically a system where the military is still a very important factor in politics, but it is true and correct to say that the government is a civilian government.
Well, of course, the analogies that have been made a lot with Turkey involve the secular versus the religious. And that's clearly been overstated, both over the years, and Mubarak has used the Muslim Brotherhood bogeyman as a way to justify his rule. But my understanding is that there was a poll done here by Middle East Institute which is, I think, a fairly pro-Israel one, suggesting that the Muslim Brotherhood was fairly insignificant and that we've yet to see the full complexion of Egyptian politics because they've been suppressed for so long. But it's by and large a fairly secular and centrist to liberal kind of country. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the, I mean, what happened basically in the 80s and to some extent in the 90s, I think was, and this is true in Egypt, but also in other countries in the region, that so many forms of legitimate political participation were suppressed, that one of the few kind of refuges, not only for politics, but also for even social activism, became religious. So young people, for example, who wanted to be involved, who wanted to serve their society, found that the only place they could really do that was in their mosques or for the Christian minority through their churches. And so it almost pushed politics into a kind of hyper-religious form. And I think that that tide had already ebbed and is no longer, you know, the rising force among particularly Egyptian youth. I mean, the Brotherhood are getting kind of old, you know. They're, I mean, it's run by people who are also of Mubarak's generation or else, you know, quite close to his generation. And among the youth, I mean, there certainly is a young following for the Brotherhood. But I think it's a grave mistake to assume that those people, for example, don't want electoral politics. The other question is, of course, you know, what happens to this, to the ruling party, which has been the dominant force in which, you know, pretty much anyone who wanted to be anybody had to join the so-called National Democratic Party of Mubarak. And this presumably is going to, I mean, it's discredited and it's going to fall apart. And so, you know, that's one point. And then if I could just go back to the previous point, I'm sorry for being not linear in this. But, you know, one of the crimes that happened not that long ago was the bombing of a Coptic church. And that has now been laid at the hands of a member of the ruling National Democratic Party. And, you know, that was seen at the time as, I mean, it was very frightening to Copts. And it was seen as an indication of, you know, the enduring and deep-seated religious animosities. But it turned out to have been a deliberately provocative political act. So I think that not only is the Brotherhood not quite as scary as we think of it from the 90s when they were blowing up tourist things and so forth, not the Brotherhood, but other radical Islamist groups. I mean, that's faded away quite substantially now. It's been a long time. Apart from these incidents that seem to have been provocations, that anything like that has happened. But in addition, you know, there's reason to believe that under a freer political system, sure, I mean, there would be religious conservatives. There are, and there are, frankly, in our country as well. But, you know, they're part of the body politic, and they get to vote and have representation in parliament, and then, you know, slug it out with other groups in society who include liberals and, for that matter, a certain number of social democrats and, you know, libertarian types. I mean, you know, there's a very wide political spectrum in Egypt.
Well, just in closing, Sheila Karapika, you're describing the NDC as a there's so many of those kind of Cold War creations that ruled in Italy and in the Liberal Democratic Party in Japan, the PRI party in Mexico, and arguably the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. There are certain similarities there. But when you mentioned earlier the judiciary, the sort of awakening judiciary, which you characterize as being very professional, and the possibility of torture trials. What about Omar Suleiman? Isn't he Mr. Torture?
Well, I mean, he is. I've certainly seen that label, and yes, I think it is quite possible. I mean, again, one major question is, you know, how many trials will they be and how far will they go? And, you know, will they concentrate at the top, which is where I believe they should be, you know, or at the guys in the police station who killed that poor young guy, Khalid Said, back in October or something like that. So, yeah, Suleiman and other leading members of the now deposed regime may indeed have to stand trial for their crimes.
Well, I thank you for joining us and for giving us a kind of an appraisal of the day after here. And let's stay in touch. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I'm glad that we were able to do this kind of bookend from the beginning to the end with you, Sheila Karapiko.
Great. Let's hope it's a new day and a good day.
Thank you again. Again, I was speaking with Sheila Karapiko, who's the chair of the Political Science Department at the American University in Cairo, where she researches the political economy of development with special emphasis on Arab countries. She's the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia, and her forthcoming book is titled Political Aid, Democracy Promotion and the Paradoxes of Empowerment. She's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. Let's now take a brief station break.